This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Among those Americans watching from home as the Afghanistan war unraveled on TV was a retired librarian named Marion Stokes. In her Philadelphia apartment, the news was always on several screens, for posterity's sake, because between 1979 and her death in 2012, her training as a librarian and her convictions as a lifelong communist activist had prompted Stokes to undertake a radical archiving project. Eventually, 70,000 tapes containing more than three decades of 24-hour TV news. About 5 years ago, documentarian Matt Wolfe got wind of the story.
I reached out to Marion Stokes' son, Michael, and I went down to Philadelphia to meet him. When I arrived at Rittenhouse Square, it was a very Tony, fancy building, and that surprised me. Inside Marion's apartment was her son Michael and her personal secretary, Frank, boxing up hundreds of Macintosh computers in their original boxing, and that was pretty surprising, too. So we went across the street to have lunch at the restaurant where Marion would have her daily martini, and Frank and Michael started to cry. And I realized that this isn't just a story about an unprecedented archive. It was an emotionally intense family story.
A story about family and also mass media hegemony, race, activism, decades of history, psychological pathology, all of which is contained within a new documentary called Recorder, the Marion Stokes Project, directed by Wolfe. He went in search of the why. Why this archive? Why Marion? And though he came away with his own guesses as to the answers, he also took on the mystery of our own news media, the story of us and how we told ourselves that story, minute by minute, for years and years. Matt, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I'd say the only thing missing is a stakeout and a chase scene, but there's one of those too. At what point did you realize what was hidden in all those hundreds and hundreds of cartons?
Well, I went about looking for specific things, whether it was an epoch-defining event or an idiosyncratic thing, and you know, anything from the collapse of the Berlin Wall to the collapse of the Miss America stage. And I would find those on tapes, but I would scan through them quickly, 7-8 hour long tapes, and I would find incredibly surprising things, things with great historical irony.
Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III. He was brought face to face with things he personally had said. For example, that the NAACP and the Civil Liberties Union are un-American organizations.
These comments that you could say about commie organization or something. I may have said something like that.
But I also found things that really represent the texture of the recent past.
Turn on the machine, pour in almost all the water, and then go pump, pump, pump.
This now is a tape of yesterday afternoon's shooting. The assailant now held to the ground. The president, who was immediately pushed into...
Strange advertisements and public service announcements, local news and talk shows. And these things, I think, reflect not only events, but they show us who we are and how the world of today came to be.
Marion was a very rich lady, living on Rittenhouse Square in Philadelphia, the poshest of neighborhoods. But she got there through a very unlikely route.
Marion was born in Philadelphia, and she was orphaned and adopted. She grew up poor and later in her life became involved in the Communist Party.
She was the Philadelphia chairman for the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, an organization started by the Communist Party to raise awareness about the Cuban Revolution.
After her divorce from her first husband, she was a single parent. Fortuitously, she got a job at a local community center called Wellsprings, and quickly she became the co-producer of their local television program called Input.
When people are killed on the courthouse steps for going up to register to vote, how can you expect Black people to have faith in the democratic process? If you want us to have faith in the democratic process, make it work.
All of us together. Not I make it work, but would you join me?
You make it work.
Would you join me?
You keep me out of your institutions.
I should keep you out?
No, you have kept me out of your institutions. Your institutions are what...
The decades of taping shows other than Input began, well, when it was possible, after Betamax came on the scene. And in November 1979...
From ABC in New York, this is World News Tonight.
Iranian students took 52 Americans hostage in our embassy in Tehran.
Good evening. The U.S. embassy in Tehran has been invaded and occupied by Iranian students.
They said the takeover had the express blessing of the Ayatollah Khomeini.
My mother was very suspicious of the official stories about the Iranian hostage crisis. And she became obsessed with the media coverage. She felt that important information was being lost as the story evolved.
She was saying, well, we've got to get this. Nobody else is going to keep this.
Good evening. Some of the rhetoric coming out of Iran today was reminiscent of the early weeks of this crisis.
As this 444-day saga unfolded, Marion was rightly concerned that important information was being lost, or that the ideological predilections of the producers of this news was coloring their depiction of the events. She saw that the nature of the media was changing.
During that crisis, she hit record and she never stopped.
She had multiple televisions playing simultaneously with VCRs, 7 to 8 hour recordings. And when the tapes ran out, it was pandemonium. Everybody in the house would be switching tapes and hitting record.
Exactly to what end? Was she looking for smoking guns of careless bias? Did she have plans to turn these hundreds of thousands of hours of tape into a scholarly study or a document of indictment? Why?
Marion wasn't interested in editorializing or selecting specific things to document. Her goal was to capture everything. And that is ultimately the work of the archivist, because we don't know what's going to be important in the future. And she knew that networks were discarding their archives. So she had the impulse to capture everything because she knew that, in a sense, archives create futures.
Marion Stokes was obsessive. And as your film makes clear, also controlling and arguably paranoid. Over the years, she became estranged from almost everyone in her life but her husband, John Stokes. So it's easy, at least in the beginning of the film, to dismiss her as just some sort of crackpot. But not so fast. Here's a cut from Northwestern University television scholar Lynn Spiegel about that reflex to dismiss someone like Marion Stokes.
When you have an institution like a museum or a university and they begin to collect, you don't tend to question why they're doing it. There must be a rational reason. But when you're one lone person, and especially a woman, then you're considered to be an outlier. We shouldn't ascribe rationality to those in power and irrationality to those without it.
Marion's an African-American woman. She was pursuing an unprecedented project that others didn't see value in. Of course, she would operate outside of the mainstream establishment of academia. She was a true radical in the sense that she saw things that other people didn't see. She was excluded from established institutions, so she took matters into her own hand and pursued her project on her own terms privately.
Now, there's a little footnote to this story. If there's such thing as a cult of Apple, Marion Stokes was like cultist number 14.
Here's to the crazy ones. The misfits. The rebels. The troublemakers. The round pegs in the square holes. The ones who see things differently.
On January 24th, Apple Computer will introduce Macintosh. And you'll see why 1984 won't be like 1984.
When the Macintosh personal computer was released, Marion saw an opportunity to democratize the production of media. She admired Steve Jobs' vision, and maybe related to him, he was difficult and demanding, but had a sense of laser focus on his project. And like Marion, he too was an orphan. And so not only did Marion invest early and invest heavily in Apple stock, she collected every single product ever released by the company during her lifetime.
It was in every corner of her apartment.
There were also tens of thousands of books, thousands of newspapers. It was kind of a vault of media and information behind closed doors.
Now, this wasn't in just one four-bedroom apartment. She had other properties to store the fruits of her collecting.
Oh, yes. Marion had multiple homes. Investing in Apple stock and making other savvy decisions about technology, stocks, and real estate really enhanced her wealth and made this project possible.
She died on December 14th, 2012.
You know, she was sitting up. They propped her up, and she was just looking very, very peaceful. But on the news, there was this horrific story unfolding.
In this small, sleepy New England town of Newtown, Connecticut, at this elementary school, the call came in to 911 right around 9:30 this morning. A gunman walked in this school. The latest number we have...
Is there any record of her thoughts about the nature of the material she collected and its effects on the audience?
You know, I think people have an impulse to pathologize Marion as some sort of compulsive amateur historian, and I wanted to be very careful not to use psychological explanations to discount her project. But I do think that you have to think about the trauma involved in watching television 24 hours a day for three decades.
And I just wonder if this is related in any way to the whole acceptance of violence and killing as an everyday thing.
Marion spoke on input about violence. She did multiple episodes that were advertised Violence for Breakfast.
Those in power are able to write their own history from their own bias. I think an extension of that certainly would be our discussion today of violence, which we may not call violence, but which is a large-scale violation of the human being's potential and humanity and dignity.
And I think that was a preoccupation for her, not just the representation of violence, but a larger kind of structural violence that's at play in society, the system that generates and produces the news and that impacts public opinion.
You mentioned that she made no effort to editorialize or to draw conclusions about the content. The archive was about itself. But as a documentarian, you had a very different approach. You use many clips from the archive as a sort of time capsule of late 20th century events. You did get to draw some conclusions. What are they?
I was just as interested in the depiction of world-defining events as really marginal things that flow through television on a daily basis.
The odds of twins living a century are said to be 1 in 700 million.
Really the detritus of popular culture.
But she wanted to be buried in her beloved Cadillac. So after the 62-year-old woman died of cancer on Thursday, she got her wish.
Things that end up in the trash can of history.
Little Jessica McClure, she's 18 months old. She's been trapped in a narrow pipe 20 feet below ground in Midland, Texas for nearly 24 hours now.
If anything, I was most concerned with trying to show how television has shaped the world of today. I mean, we live in this era of so-called fake news. And I think Marion was very concerned about that kind of phenomena emerging as the 24-hour news cycle took hold. And I was thinking a lot about, why is this archive significant now? And I tried to track threads through politics and history that spoke to our current moment.
There's a second kind of thing that the CIA does, and that's to take secret action to change what goes on in another country. This could involve giving money to help a candidate win an election. It might involve aiding in the overthrow of a government, which we think is a threat to us. It could even mean arranging or trying to arrange an assassination.
Or tracking the depiction of police brutality as presented on television.
Granted, the video doesn't tell you everything, but it sure looks like the deputies were using excessive force, and it sure looks like the Rodney King beating all over again.
There was a few instances of people discussing the threat of ideological interests impacting media. A Phil Donahue talk show with major newscasters talking about undue corporate influence on the news.
We are owned by larger and larger companies.
It doesn't make me a radical to be somewhat concerned about white male boardroom view will be even more a feature.
This conversation was percolating, but it was before the advent of cable news with its ideological slants, and people were anticipating the kind of moment we're in now in which the truth is under attack. And in a lot of ways, I think it's important to look at Marianne's project as a form of activism. She was recording and capturing everything because she felt that important information was being lost and she wanted to protect the truth.
Well, whatever ultimate truth can be drawn from this vast collection, there was someone who recognized it, the Internet Archive, that Bay Area organization that in many ways is cataloging the entirety of the Internet. They understood the value of the tape, and they have undertaken to digitize the whole kit and caboodle for posterity. Never mind the notes that Marianne Stokes wrote on the spines of the VHSs. This is a monumental databasing problem, hundreds of thousands of hours of programming, but they had an astonishingly lucky break.
When we sent them the test box, they immediately began to realize that the early days of my mother's taping were also the early days of closed captioning. They can use the closed captioning as a tag that lets people know and search what's happening in the actual videotape.
So as the Internet Archive digitizes her tapes, they'll be able to associate closed captioning with it so that people can search this enormous corpus of media by keyword. And that's a real game changer. I mean, we normally look at analog media linearly. We have to screen through the entire tapes, as I did. But it's a real game changer to be able to look through a giant pool of media by keyword.
And when will we actually have access as consumers to the Stokes collection?
The Internet Archive is at the earliest stages of this vast project, but there's urgency to it. People forget how fragile VHS tape is as a medium. It's literally disintegrating day by day.
All right, Matt. Throughout this process, you were in the position of mediating Marianne Stokes. Did you think at all about what she might think of your project?
Of course. I've made films about a number of people who aren't around to speak for themselves, and it's a real dilemma. What's the fair way to tell somebody's story? It wouldn't have been fair for me to make some sort of rose-tinted portrait that ignored the fact that her behavior was dysfunctional and that it was hurtful to other people. But I wanted to assume that there was real meaning and conviction behind this project, and I recognized her as a visionary. Marianne was a private person who didn't want to be known, but I do know that she told Michael, her son, at the end of her life, "Who's going to tell my story?" And in a lot of ways, I took that as a cue. What she did is of historical significance, and it's newsworthy itself.
Marianne Stokes hit record way back in 1977. She didn't stop until December of 2012. All of that history arriving today by truck at an archive in San Francisco from Stokes' home.
I don't think Marianne could have ever imagined that herself and her project would be broadcast on CNN alongside all the news that she was capturing.
It's a bit meta in a way that makes my head hurt.
I don't think of it that way. I think Marianne took on the totality of the media. Through the lens of her very peculiar and very unexpected story, I think there's insights to be gleaned about where we are today and how we got here.
Matt, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Matt Wolf is the director of Recorder, the Marianne Stokes Project.
We don't believe what's on TV. Because it's what we want to see. And what we want, we know we can't believe. We have all learned to kill our dreams.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Michael Loewinger, Leia Fetter, John Hanrahan, and Asta Chetivetti. We had more help from Charlotte Gartenberg, who's leaving us this week. Thank you so much, Charlotte, and good luck with everything. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Josh Hahn and Sam Baer. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
What I've told my friends, don't wanna know who I am.
Beyond the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.